Welcome to the Negotiations Ninja podcast, where we develop and deliver the most engaging negotiation content and training in the world. We host negotiation experts, business people, and entrepreneurs, and discuss what works, what doesn't work, and how we can improve our negotiation skills. Hello, Negotiations Ninja listeners. You've got Mark here from the Negotiations Ninja podcast. Today, my amazing guest is Patrick Tinney. He's a return guest on the show. We've had him on a few times, negotiation author and expert. And as in Patrick Tinney fashion, we riff on a few different ideas and get into the nuts and bolts on how he's found success, a few of his different books, and some of the things that we talk about are really, really interesting. I really enjoyed this conversation, as I usually do with my good friend Pat. Enjoy this great conversation with Pat Tinney. Encourage you to reach out to him online. Thank you so much. Pat Tinney.
Hello. Hey, Mark. How you doing?
Fantastic, pal. How are you?
I just wish I was out in Alberta, man. Stampede's on right now.
Yeah, man. For the listeners who are listening in, we will record this on the last Friday of Stampede being Calgary's Mardi Gras, basically.
The greatest show on earth.
It is pretty incredible. If you're into rodeo, then it's amazing. If you're not into rodeo, you'll still have a great time.
If you're into raucous eating and absolutely insane fall on your face drinking so bad that you have to burn at least 3 cowboy hats in a week because they're all covered in mucus.
Unfortunately, it gets pretty gross. It gets pretty gross occasionally, like definitely.
Those buses that roll back and forth on 2 sets of tires while they're going between bars. Oh my God. I got pie-eyed one time and I ended up on the roof of the Palliser with a girl and our legs were dangling over. We were in the Silver Slipper and security guard walked by. And he looked out the window, and I thought he was having a heart attack. And he goes, "Hey, guys, how you doing?" And I looked over my shoulder. I said, "Cool." Like, we were 5 stories up when our legs dangling over the edge. He said, "Would you come here?" I said, "Okay." I said, "Come on. Let's go in and see what this guy wants." We got close to the window, and he grabbed the 2 of us and pulled us through the window. What a great time.
Oh, wow. That sounds like Stampede.
It is Stampede, man. I've been in bars where people ride into their horses.
Yeah, that happens.
It does happen.
It's a wild time. It's a wild time. It's a good time. It definitely separates us sort of from many of our cities in Canada.
Oh, man.
But that's not why we're here. We're here to understand the bonus round. That's what I want to know about.
Yeah.
But before we get into that discussion, maybe tell the listeners a bit about who you are and what you do.
Well, I've been in the sales and negotiation training business now for 14 years under my own banner called Centroid Training and Marketing. I've worked with some amazing clients. The very first client that I ever worked with was KPMG. And since then, I've worked with some amazing people that are looking for things that are unique. They're looking for unique perspectives on sales and negotiation. And I also think that they're looking for a way to set themselves above average. Because average gets you a paycheck. Above average gets you to your dreams as quickly as possible. And I'm all about that. I'm all about embracing positive risk and thinking bigger than we are, fighting above our belt weight, and being confident that we can do it. Now, you might not get it done on the first, second, third, or fourth time, but you know what? Eventually, you're going to get there if you believe in yourself.
I like that about your messaging in your content. It's very positive. It's very focused towards achievement. It's very focused towards doing better and getting better. And that's what I like about the bonus round. So for those listeners who don't know, that's Pat's latest book, but I don't want to steal his thunder. Pat, why the bonus round and why now?
When the pandemic started, I just started writing some pieces about thinking bigger. I started writing some pieces about what happens when the wheels fall off the buggy. What happens when you get lost? What happens when you have nowhere to go? What happens when you're being called out? What happens when you're trying to be the most creative person that you can be in a corporate setting? What happens when you're under extreme pressure? You know, like my territory in those days, and I think the second youngest guy they hired there in corporate sales, but my territory was $35 million a year in the early 90s. That's a lot of jobs. A large contract for me was $13 million with one signature. That's 150 jobs. So it's being able to manage that much pressure. And once you understand what it takes to get those kinds of deals across the finish line and the complexity, I was representing 125 newspapers simultaneously. So there's a lot of meat on the business cases that I bring to the bonus round. And really what I wanted to do was to not deliver a whole bunch of theory, not deliver, you know, a new way to get to the moon. What I wanted to give to people was solid business cases that they could read over and over and over again and say to themselves, all right, so what did Pat do when he was in the middle of a disaster? How did he turn lemons into lemonade? And that was really where I was heading. And I also wanted to talk about some unusual things in the corporate world, like how you know, regardless of what the company thinks that they want you to do, how it is that you're going to manage your own career. In other words, don't let people manage you. You manage up. The very smartest people in business manage up. They don't allow themselves to be managed down. And the other thing is to get involved with groups within the company that you wouldn't otherwise get involved with, product launches, understand what's under the hood of what it is that you sell, take it apart. Like, I was the first sales rep in Canada to become a certified print production practitioner. In other words, I looked at my industry not as a product. I looked at my industry as an ecosystem. And what I wanted to do was I wanted to see how many different ways I could repurpose what it is that we already made. And that, believe it or not, is what caused me to launch. The last product I launched at the company was called Print, Plan, and Distribute. We were one of the biggest printers in Canada, but the kind of printing that I wanted would happen outside of the company. I approached several printers. I found a couple that I liked, and we put a package together, and I presented it to all of the reps internally, and I said, we can do this. And what I did was I actually, in some cases, asked printers to raise their prices to fit my model. And then we took it to market, and the first order, I think, was 6 million pieces across Canada, one delivery, and we never had one complaint. I ended up in the first two quarters doing 1 million unbudgeted. But the only way you get there is by building up your risk tolerance and understanding just how much pressure goes with that. Pushing back at senior management when they say, listen, we want this to go today. And you just sort of say, no, I'm sorry, I'm not going to launch today. And if people come in and they want your stuff and they say, you know, I understand what you're doing, you don't give me this right now, then I'm going to go to senior management and they're going to pressure you to give it to me. And I would say, fine, take it as it is. But caveat emptor, I'm not sure it's perfect yet. And until I can go to sleep at night, until I know that whatever it is that I've done in my corporate setting proofs up beautifully so that everybody can touch it, feel it, and walk out and say, if Pat says it's ready to go, we're bulletproof.
Something that you talk a lot about is positive risk and how positive risk is a mindset. What do you mean by that?
So one of the things that a bunch of people don't know about me was that I was a swing trader in the stock market for many years. So I don't believe there's one way to make money. I just think there's a whole pile of ways to make money. And if you're really good at understanding how business works, it's one of the things that makes me quite unique. When I walk into companies, I start talking to them about culture and balance sheets and product launches and where you want to go. I'm not there to talk about pain points. Who cares? You know, I mean, if you're one of those people that walks in and steps on the person's, you are living 20 years ago. Companies don't care about that. If they don't understand their pain points, they shouldn't be in business. So I'm there to walk in and say, okay, so really happy to get together. I'm going to ask some really odd questions. But the oddest question I want to ask you is, if you look at your revenue opportunities right now, and then you look at your resources, and you look at your teams, and you look at their skill sets, you're looking at revenue that you can't touch because you don't have the skill to get there. You don't have the mindset to get there. And one of the things that I talk to people a lot about these days is benchmarking, because there's two big problems that's happening in the corporate world. Pandemic has just exacerbated both of them. But one is that you got staff turnover that's a little more rapid than it used to be. And that's kind of considered normal because that's the 20, 30 leading into the early 40s crowd. They're very fluid right now. And they're right to be that way because this is something that I predicted maybe 15 years ago, that a job was going to be an anomaly. A number of jobs was going to create a career. And I presented this to, I was on the advisory committee for Sheridan College's advertising program. I remember the first time that I presented that to them, it was probably 16 or 17 years ago. They looked at me like I was insane, but I think their world has shifted.
How do you tie in people to think about positive risk? Because I think it's all good and well for us to sit here and say, hey, you've got to play with risk a little bit more and you've got to be more open to it. And yes, you obviously should have measures in place to mitigate against that, of course. But how do you get someone into the mindset to take on more risk?
That's a wonderful question. And I don't think many people have asked me that. So why don't I just sort of share what I do to create that moment? So let me go back to say that I was the first salesperson in Canada that became a certified print expert. And I didn't even work with the equipment, but I memorized the textbook. And I wrote a 93 in my final. And I can remember her name was Margaret McLeod. She said, great job, Pat. She said, this is the most amazing regurgitation I've ever seen in my life. But here's the thing. When I was at the Toronto Star, I remember being called in by one of the senior managers there. And he goes, Pat, he says, all the sales reps on the floor, it's about 100 of them. They're all thinking about marketing. You're thinking about printing. Are you leaving the company? I said, no. Why are you doing that? I said, because everybody else is doing the other thing. I don't want to look like them. But I really want to know why. When I'm out talking to a customer, I want to be able to speak intelligently about them if they have an idea that they want to explore. But secondarily, if something goes wrong, I want to be able to explain it in the moment. I don't want to have to come back here and talk to some guy who's in a union who's going to protect himself, because that's what people do in those environments. They call it alternative management, and that's fine. And I had to work in a union at the Toronto Star, and it was just part of the deal. But I thought outside, you know, rather than thinking out of the box, I became the box. And so I'm sitting with this manager, and he says, if we have a problem, we have the best professionals in the industry. I call upstairs. I get an explanation. They give me the explanation. I go back to the customer full-throated, and I say, here's what went wrong. Here's what we're going to do. And I said, that's cool. But do you really believe what they're telling you? Because I don't. Should have seen the look on his face. It was like I dropped a grenade in his lap, because he probably thought of about 20 situations where he was unsure about the answer that he got, but he had to be confident with his explanation to the customer, regardless of whether it was right or wrong. You see, once you've gone off and done different things, like, you know, I went and studied management studies, and I thought, well, that's okay, but now I want to go off and study public speaking, which I did. And when that was done, I thought, you know, better go up and take a trip up and have a look at university, see what it looks like. But I was horrible at algebra. I knew it. I had horrible teachers as a kid, but I knew I couldn't pass the algebra course. So they had another course there. It was called Persuasion and Advertising, which was a total lie. The course was about logic. It was a philosophy course. And one of the key elements of that course was being able to pass the logicians. So you got 500 of us in a big class, right? And there's two professors that look like little people down on the stage. And the one takes his arm and he goes across the room and he says, you see this third of you in the room? We know you can't pass that test. We've been doing this a long time. So better think quick and decide whether you want to risk being in this room and failing or going on to do something else that you'd be successful at. I thought I was going to die. So I just put my head down and I developed a way to memorize all of the truth table elements. And when we wrote the exam, I wrote a perfect. Now, what that did for me was it helped me as I moved into the senior part of my career, into management and into product development and going out and seeing suppliers, I would ask myself, is the explanation they're giving me deduction and induction, or is it just a random possibility? Back to risk. You know how I kept my risk profile up? I'd go up and play long sessions of no hold'em limit poker. As a matter of fact, my wife bought me two tours. She bought me a tour to Windsor to play at Caesars. And I left there with a little bit of money. But we went down to Las Vegas and I rolled a natural royal flush at Bally's.
No way.
Yeah. And there's a straight flush about two hands before me. So nobody ever would have expected that coming. I've never seen a royal flush. And I've
straight flush and a royal flush in one game?
In about 5 minutes. So the straight flush won the house prize. And then when I rolled my royal against the guy who had a very strong flush hand, and we were both all in. So that meant that we both probably had, I don't know, $700 each in the middle. And then whatever else everybody else had put in the middle. And then all of a sudden the screening started. And I thought I'd done something wrong. And I left Vegas with $2,500 and collected another $800 with holding tax when I got back. And I'd go play very long sessions. The longest poker session I'd played probably on a Saturday would be 20 hours in a row.
Whoa, that's a long time.
Yeah. So
I'm about checked out after 6 hours.
Yeah. Most people can't maintain their concentration that long. But you see, what it does is that it keeps you into what I call a, you know, almost like a risk bubble. So you're constantly having to understand what's happening at the table. You're constantly having to observe how people deceive other people, how people hide their emotions. One of the things that you want to look at, if you watch a lot of poker, the one thing a human cannot control when they're stressed or when they're excited,
what's that?
Is what part of your body?
My guess is your facial expressions, but everyone talks about poker faces, so maybe your feet?
Your lower lip.
Oh, your lower lip. Interesting.
That's why you'll see poker pros do this when they've got a good hand. They all do it, except for the really good ones, like Daniel Negreanu, Phil Ivey. I can name probably 10 or 15 people who just, they're stone-faced. But that gives you this air of, even if I'm not entirely sure I can complete this mission, it gives me that wholeheartedness to explore it, because I've put real money on the table and I've done it over and over again, and I've done it with the company. I've taken gigantic risks within the company that other people wouldn't take. People were telling me I was crazy on several occasions. But, you know, the thing is, you can never be called a fool for daring to try. I mean, people may try. I've had people try and do it, but I just proved them wrong. Now, in the meantime, you fail several times, but I don't call them failures. I call them iterations. Edison didn't fail when he was building the light bulb. All he was doing was he was trying different ways to do the same thing over and over again until he actually got to the point where he had a light bulb. When Dyson was working on his vacuum cleaners in his workshop, he actually first became successful in Japan because they like gizmos. And most people couldn't understand a vacuum cleaner as a cyclone. And he did. But what he did was he went back and he said, all right, so now I need to take my invention and turn it into a product that Westerners will finally accept. And then when I get finished that product, what's the next thing that I'm going to build? Because you always have to have the crazy project in the corner. I mean, I always had one that was so far out, like my bosses would call me and say, what are you working on now? All right, so I'm thinking about this. I know it's not going to work, but I'm going to go at it anyway. If you can go to the marketplace with a new idea that gives a customer an advantage for 4 weeks, 4 weeks is an eternity. They will leap across the table and grab you by the throat. They're not going to let you leave the room if they know that they can have that idea before their competitors. That is positive risk. That's creativity. That's being the box and having people tell you to get in the box or think outside the box. Who gives a rat's ass?
Hey, listeners, I want to tell you about another company that I run called Content Callout. It is a thought leadership brand marketing company. Now, what does that mean? It means that we take you as an executive or entrepreneur, a leader of a small or medium-sized business, and we turn you into a thought leader online. We take your personal brand and we amp it up to 11. So that you can lead with confidence, knowing that people will recognize you, recognize your brand, and recognize your business because of the thought leadership approach that you've taken on social media through content creation and content distribution, as well as engaging with all of your following online. How do you get involved in this? Easy, easy, easy. Just go to contentcallout.com/get-started, and you will see there three different options that will allow you to take your thought leadership brand for yourself and for your business to the next level. We are super excited to talk to you about this. We've seen some massive growth with the businesses that we've been working with. Very, very exciting time for us. Look at that. We appreciate it. Now back to your show. There's a component here that I think a lot of people miss, though, and it's the creativity component, because we could say, yes, we need to take more positive risk, but a lot of people listening to that would say, well, I don't know if I'm creative enough. So how do we create these creative solutions so that people can take a positive risk? Where do you learn that? How do you develop that?
It's having a tolerance for not accepting the norm. You can read good creative books, I mean, on creative thinking. I like Six Thinking Hats because it allows me to think in another language. There's another book on creative thinking. I'll think about it later. But, you know, it's how to focus on creativity. Jeb Blunt has a wonderful term that he uses called murder boarding. That's where you've got an idea and you just keep asking yourself questions over and over and over and over again about that idea. Tell me a million ways that this is wrong and then tell me two ways that we could be on some kind of a course. So let me give you an example. So when everybody hated Facebook, when it first IPO, companies worth about $60 billion, right? But the problem was they didn't have video available on the platform in the beginning. It was just kind of a chat thing, right? You could put pictures up and that kind of stuff. And I thought to myself, all right, so the market's getting down on the people at Facebook because they don't have video. What would I do if I was Mark Zuckerberg? Well, if I was Mark Zuckerberg and I had $60 billion, I would peel off $1 billion, which is about 1.5% of the company. And I would call the 10 brightest guys and women into a meeting and say, friends, you can assemble any team you want, but you'll be observed as a team. And at the end of the day, the person who comes up with the best ideas on getting video on Facebook wins a $1 million prize. And this goes on until the end of the year where we complete the project. That's when I bought $50,000 US worth of Facebook at 27.
Smart move.
It's really just looking at the business case and discussing probabilities with yourself. And then just saying to yourself, do we have enough smart people out there to complete it?
So it's about searching for opportunities, but also basically saying, what are all the things that could go wrong? And then where are the opportunities this could go right? And if there's one or two, going for it.
Yeah. And then go try them fearlessly. I don't care if I fall down. I don't care if I get punched in the face. I don't care. What is that? I think this whole idea of people being afraid to make cold calls is garbage. All you're doing is you're trying to make new friends. Are you afraid of making new friends? Because if you get a great customer, you've got a friend for life. You know, when I was a kid, my dad died when I was really young, and I had to go shoveling snow. And I'd probably make, I don't know, a couple of hundred calls a day when I was out on a full day on a weekend. My failure ratio was probably, I don't know, 95%. But, you know, I figured if I could get 10 customers that day, I'd walk away with $20. And when you're a little kid, that's a lot of money. I just didn't think about it as them saying no to me. I just thought, oh, maybe they don't have any money today. Thanks. I hope you have a good day. And how do you say no to a little kid with a shovel that's bigger than him, who's sweaty? You know, I guess my view of the world is a little bit different. You know, I'm never really, really big on top-down thinking. Top-down thinking is great. Being a guy who's been involved in retail for a lot of my life, I always wondered, what was the motivation to make a cash register ring? And I wanted to understand that emotional state, the ambiance in the store, the lighting, the store layout, why people would get happy, why people would go insane to get a Cabbage Patch doll and fight each other in a line. It's fascinating to watch. And I love to watch people when I run my training sessions and sometimes in discussions just like this, Mark, when they have a moment where you go, I just changed the trajectory of his thinking. She just had an aha moment. We rarely remember what people say. I'm not sure who the person was that first said this, but I'm not the first. We rarely remember what people say. We don't always remember what we read, but we always remember the feeling that people gave us. And I was talking to a real estate agent recently, actually a couple of them, new ones. And I said, how you doing? He says, well, you know, he says, I'm working really hard. And he says, I'm not making enough money. And I said, well, what do you think's going wrong? And he says, well, I don't know. Sometimes customers don't buy and, you know, they want to ride around my car and look at the house. I said, I hate to say it. There's two things you got to start doing. You got to start qualifying people really hard and really fast, which is what most salespeople are afraid of these days. I'm the opposite. I'm looking for hot money in the market, smart money. Why do I want to chase cars that are parked? How many dogs do you see chasing parked cars? Not many. They're after a car that's got something good in it. And I'm one of those dogs. And if you're a guy out there who thinks he's a big dog, watch out for the little guy like me who's circling your bowl, because eventually I'm going to get to it.
Such colorful analogies.
You know, it's a state of mind. And if you have that state of mind in a corporate environment, your managers are actually looking for that. That's the thing they want. They don't want some steady Eddie. I said this in a podcast, I don't know, about a month ago. The thing that would disgust me the most is if I was remembered as a steady Eddie. Are you kidding? What a waste. I told this guy, this real estate agent, I said, pick up my book, Unlocking Yes, because most people in real estate have three ponies that they ride. You know, Split the Difference, which is genius, A Bully Bid, which is even a bigger genius, and Will You Take This Price, which is desperation. And I basically said to him, I said, I can name about 30 buyer negotiation strategies off the top of my head. I've cataloged 25. But I said, wouldn't you like to be the guy that when you walk in the room, people went, whoa, that's the guy.
Pat, whenever I talk to you, I always get the sense that I need to pick up another book. There's always something that I walk away with going like, oh shit, I need to study that more.
I read about 25 in a year, so I'm as desperate as you are.
Desperate for knowledge, like me. Listen, there's going to be people out here that are desperate for your knowledge. So if people want to find you online and find your books, how do they do that?
Well, I really enjoy LinkedIn. So you can find me there. If you're in sales and you're really into it, send me a connect. Number two, I've got a website, centroidmarketing.com. All I do is really drop my name and sales author into any search engine, pops up. And there's lots of goodies on there. Take them now before I start to put a gate up and charging people, because it's going to happen soon. And I would say the third way is to pick up the phone. See, a phone isn't a rattlesnake. It's actually something you can hold in your hand and communicate with. There's also a new thing called Zoom. It's insane. You plug in a date, a time, and somebody's email address, and you say, hi. And the other person says, oh my God, it's you. I know. What a strange happening. The easiest way to find out about me is to, wherever you are in the world, whatever Amazon you use, whether it's Amazon India, Amazon UK, Amazon Canada, US, Italy, just plug in my name, Patrick Tinney, and hit the button, and all my books pop up. With, I'm almost up to 100 five-star reviews across the books.
When are you going to put a box set together?
About the same time I get around to finishing an audiobook. My challenge is that I really enjoy creating the content, but there's only so many hours in a day. And so I'm actually working on about three different ideas for books right now. I had a creative rush about a month ago, and I wrote 15,000 words in about 8 days. So all I need to do is come up with another maybe 20,000 words, and I've got a book.
Amazing.
Yeah. I wrote Perpetual Hunger in 7 weeks.
Whoa.
It took me 7 years to finish Unlocking Yes. And there's a reason why. Writing a negotiation book is probably the hardest thing to do in business. I can't think of anything harder. As a matter of fact, I can tell when people haven't actually done deals, but they've written books.
Isn't that the truth?
No. You know, when we go offline, like, I'll tell you, there's a reason why. You know, one of the things you asked me about was, you've got these examples and stories and business cases and all the rest of it. Have you ever wondered why I don't quote people in my books? I don't need to. I proof up. That's why when I train people, it's all field tested. And you know how it's been field tested? With real customers. I'm the only guy that you probably ever heard of that's walked away from Walmart in a deal.
Well, good sir, it has been a pleasure, as always.
I got to tell you, always fun to jam with you, because you cut me loose. You ask insane questions, and you ask questions that maybe some other people just haven't thought of, it, but you're just coming at it from a different angle. And I think that's your part of your procurement background. It's part of your industry knowledge. It's also part of your curiosity. It's part of who Mark is. You got to tell people about the white shark cage.
Oh, yeah.
You should do a podcast on that alone.
That was a scary day, man. I almost shit myself on that post.
If you want a reason to call Mark, you got to call him up and say, what happened when things went wrong with the white shark? Do you know that white sharks never stop growing?
Yeah, I did know that. They also never stop swimming.
Yeah. You know, the biggest one.
Just hunting and eating machines.
Yeah. The biggest one, they think, weighs around 5,000 pounds. I don't know how long it is, but it's deep.
Amazing. Yeah, they get fat. They just get thick.
Yeah.
Yeah. Amazing. Well, Pat, listen, man, this was an amazing experience. Thank you very much. For the listeners, just so that you know, you should go pick up all of Pat's book. They're all fantastic, especially the bonus round. Go buy it today. Pat, a pleasure as always.
Thanks, Mark. You know, thanks. First of all, I think what people have to understand about podcasters like you is, you know, you're putting in the time. You're risking things by having people on your show, because your time is your equity. And I appreciate you deeply.
Hey friends, thanks so much for listening to this episode. If you enjoyed it, please share it with friends and colleagues so that they can benefit from it as well. If you find Negotiations Ninja Podcast worthy, please go onto iTunes and give us a cool rating with a nice review. We certainly appreciate every single one that we get, because it helps us to understand who is listening, how they're listening, and what it is they like. If there's something that you would like me to discuss around negotiation, influence, or persuasion, give me a shout. You know how to reach me on social media, or you can get me on my website, which is www.negotiations.ninja.